Shall we take non-members first?
I'd like to ask Comrade Young why I agree that Rosa Luxemburg, as a fighter and a supporter of the class struggle, I'm more concerned on the economic theories she held. You mentioned the claps theory, where she the party takes opposite views to Rosa Luxemburg, but also her accumulation capital, which was roundly criticised, not only in Germany by Karin and others. She put forward a theory there that worldwide capitalism was impossible. Would you say that fundamentally she was unsound on Marxian economics?
Well, I certainly would agree with you that there was a fallacy. She put forth, it's a very entertaining and a very plausible theory. She said this, that capitalism depends for its existence upon a non-capitalist periphery. She said, where are they going to get their raw material and their profits and so on, unless there's this undeveloped... I would think myself, and I find difficulty in following the logic and the reasoning here, because I've always followed the... exposition in the Communist Manifesto that capitalism creates all over the world, that the backward countries see in the advanced countries the mirror of their own image. And I think the party would take the view that capitalism will spread everywhere. So that in this case, you've got a point. Oh, one other thing, while we've got a minute to spare, we get this awful Communist Party of Germany publication, which prints the most incredible rubbish. I mean, poor old Rosa wouldn't turn in her grave, she'd revolve at speed. But they sometimes print a historical section, 50 years ago or 20 years ago, like we do in Social Standard. And this one is an account of a meeting attended by Liebknecht and subsequently a tea party of friends after the meeting, when Liebknecht said, "I promise I will not disappoint the comrades." In other words, in December 1914, he was already saying he was going to take the anti-war stand, and there were already members in Berlin who were supporting this. I'll pass this round because there's a photograph of it there, and you can see that they all look extremely prosperous. I don't know if that's a wedding cake in the middle.
Yes.
Liebknecht's in the middle. Yes?
Would you say that, like many other parties, the Spartacists included, of course, its members and leaders, like Rosenberg and talking about now, were bourgeois intellectuals which have no roots in the working class and have become abstract in the realities of their situation?
No, I wouldn't say that, but nobody in his wildest dreams could contend that Rosa Luxemburg was a worker in any sense. In that sense, she never did a day's work in her life. She went straight from college to writing and speaking, and spent her entire life in political activity. However, I wouldn't, and I think I could say we wouldn't necessarily take the view that it makes her right or wrong.
Oh,
it's Marx and everybody.
Would I be able to say also that, as I personally believe, that Marxism himself, Marx, and consequently Marxism, is a bourgeois intellectual, a kind of a charitable sin, look on the workers, and it has no real roots in the working class, and is built around the 1800s, that charitable philanthropic attitude, and is built. It's because of its economic theory, which says that the economics go to the masses of the people, which in reality must be led by a minority, consequently gives into the hands of a minority, even if they try to become the authority of all the masses of the people. It's a paradox to itself.
I'm afraid you were going
What's
to the question.
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 Well,
the question.
Question
is, I think that Rosenberg was one of these bourgeois intellectuals.
That's not a question.
Well, all right, you can say that.
No, I'm not a great question. That in a sense, but I think it was a weakness of the Spartacus movement. It didn't have any roots in the real working class. It spoke above, shall we say, in the language of their conception, what it is.
Well, if you're asking me, did the Social Democratic Party have the support of the great mass of the German working class? Yes, it did. Yeah. No doubt. And the mistake of the Spartacus group was in imagining that they had more support than they actually did. My own view is that I've thought about this, and I've thought about our modern life, and I've come to the conclusion that it's very easily possible to be impressed by meetings. I mean, you go to what's called a vast mass meeting, but what is it? Might be 5,000, might be something like that. And you become impressed by this, and you think that this is the whole of the world. It seems to me that a lot of the work of the first Socialist International was like this. They had these vast mass demonstrations, but when it came to the actual election, there were still millions who voted against them.
Can I have the next question, please?
Perhaps they want to think.
What was the attitude of the Socialist Party of Great Britain and its companion parties towards the Spartacists? Was it any liaison?
No, never, but I suppose you know, and we printed in the Socialist Standard quite correctly, you know, her intervention, when she spoke at the 1907 meeting of the International Socialist Bureau, the Second International, she got there, she had to contrive to get what's called a mandate, she had to get a delegate's ticket, and the way she got there was as a representative of the Polish Social Democratic Party. And this is how she acquired prominence, which she would have had a hard job to do in Germany itself. And the Socialist Standard in January the 5th, 1907, she had already been tried and sentenced at Weimar for this statement about the Kaiser. And the Socialist Standard said, "Well done, Red Rosa. You have grandly expressed the sentiments of the class-conscious workers of the world, and may you live to see the social revolution accomplished." Unfortunately, during the war, as you know, there was no sort of contact whatsoever, and it was only after the war, and even then, although we did have members who had originally come here from Germany and went back to Germany, and also Austria, it never, in those days, in the 20s, developed to anything of any importance, no more than individual members. Although Franz Neumann, according to the Socialist Standard, I myself was astonished to read this, but I'm assured on good authority it's absolutely true, Franz Neumann, who was interned in the Alexandra Palace, all the German nationals were put in the Alexandra Palace during the First World War, and went back again to Germany, and apparently was shot in the suppression of the Spartacus revolt in Berlin. I didn't know this till Bartrop. Dropped. But it's in the Standard. Lost his life in there.
Yes.
Another question. Can I see first whether there's anyone else before you have a second bite of the chair? Anyone else?
Question.
Could my young take up this point that the voice on the balcony raised, you know, even though he was too late to hear most of the opening remarks, that the working class need leadership, and that it is the intellectual people who have no roots in the working class who tend to rise in the working class movement?
The only thing I would say, as we're talking specifically about Rosa Luxemburg, one individual character, I would say that she's an anti-leader, in the sense that she said we will never do anything without the fully conscious agreement and cooperation of the mass of the German workers. I mean, but to the extent that her social background was such that she decided, and I think quite rightly, that her talents, her immense talents, qualified her to play a prominent political part in Germany, and as a Marxist, she decided to do it in the Social Democratic Party of Germany. Well, that's it. It just occurred.
Another weakness, which is it's been suggested that Rosa Luxemburg had, was that she never concerned herself with questions of organisation. She was more a sort of charismatic figure who didn't worry about the problems of making an organisation genuinely democratic. Because, of course, the Social Democratic Party was, in formal terms, a democratic organisation. In practice, it was dominated by a group of leaders who were trusted by the masses of the members. because of their long service, whatever their views might have been. And this has gone into, in Mitchell's book, also political parties, about the problem of making formal democracy real, and that Rosa Luxemburg never worried about such matters if they were too mundane, for her. Do you think that is a fair criticism?
Yes, I would think so. I mean, from what I've read of the biographies of her and what I've heard about her from people who knew her, she certainly was obviously a very keen public speaker. She obviously loved the life of going around and addressing all the local organisations and the conferences and so on, and writing all the time. It is true, as far as I know, that there are no articles much about organisations. She was too preoccupied with fundamental principles, especially the question of the ultimate goal, the capture of political power, and nature of the working class party. I think you could say that she was concerned with organisation to the extent that she differed fundamentally from the Bolsheviks with their democratic centralism. She certainly was in favour of democracy there, but I don't know of any cases where she took up the question of organisation as such.
Well, you say she differed from the Bolsheviks. In that respect, I agree, but she was similar in this respect, I suppose, that she viewed that socialism couldn't do it in one country. Otherwise, wouldn't have entered into this revolt.
No, I don't think that would be true. Don't overlook the fact that they were, to a certain extent, well, there's several things about this. Both Bukharin and Radek, who were there, were utterly horrified when they found the actual state of affairs. That is, that there was no real preparations for it. They were relying on the spontaneous... They made a call for the uprising and trusted to luck, more or less, you see. And Radek wrote back to Moscow and said that there was nothing ready. I could quote you from Nettle's biography. But... no, I don't think she would think that. She was an internationalist above everything, and what they thought they were doing was linking up with Russia and hoping for revolts in France and Italy and places. No, she was an internationalist. I don't think she was out for a separate national German revolution. Apart from the fact, of course, by her very nature, she came in for quite a lot of stick. They actually called her the Polish Jewess, and even in the Social Democratic Party. And the foreigner and all these sort of epithets, you know.
Was she a Trotskyist?
Oh, by no means.
Well, Trotskyists have the same international attitude, not with the revolutionary.
She disagreed with Trotsky even more than with Lenin.
How do you explain your relation to supporting the Rosenberg with the Article 7 of your party, which says at the end, the party seeking working class emancipation must be outside of the other party.
That's right.
How long can you do it so in isolation? You can't support anyone who's outside your this article. But no other party except your party, the SVGB, is the leader of the working class.
No, you're reading something that's not there, aren't you?
Well,
look, shall we read it again?
Yes.
Slowly. It's got to be here somewhere. Number 7, that as all parties are but the expression of class interests, right? And as the interest of the working class is diametrically opposed to the interests of all sections of the master class, the party seeking working class emancipation must be hostile to every other party.
Must be hostile to itself.
What is the question or the objection?
It must be hostile to any other party.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, can I make the reason clear? The reason is that if you join with any other party which is not committed exclusively to the establishment of socialism, you, by that, cease to be a socialist party. And I would say in this connection, as we're talking about this tonight, in a sense, with all her resolute determination not to allow herself to be chucked out of the Social Democratic Party of Germany, even Rosa Luxemburg was forced by the logic of events into that situation. And she did eventually leave and formed a new party, hostile to all other parties, in this case the Communist Party of Germany. But in our case, in the case of the SPGB, the reason is that if you join hands with or make pacts with any other party, whatever it calls itself, you cease to be a socialist party. You can't be one or the other. You can't be both.
Well, So like a conservative could say, the left is all right in its division.
I don't know what a conservative would say because I'm not a speaker for the Conservative
Why
Party.
Why can't the SPGB...
Now, what is it you're trying to tell us something?
I'm asking you, why doesn't the SPGB associate itself with others, despite what you may think, or they may think of you on the wrong road?
Well, I'll tell you again, I'll be very patient, because all these others are not socialists.
You are socialists.
Now, the answer is they are not socialists. Now, whether we are socialists or not is up to you to decide. We can say what we stand for, and if you don't think that's right or socialism, well, that's all right.
So the working class is divided by conservative against it.
Now, well, you're not asking me questions. You're stating your prejudices. So I can't help that.
Would you give somebody else a chance?
Does he come straight from Mass?
I don't know. Massachusetts.
Anyone else? Then?
I come from a deep working class.
Yeah, underground.
It seems to me that if there was somebody like Rosa Luxemburg around now in Germany or anywhere else in the world, we'd make the Socialist Party of Great Britain would make some stirring efforts to get in touch with her. Yet, as far as one can see, as far as one knows from bits of party history, we weren't sort of concerned. And the SPGB was busy with trying to deal with socialism in England at the time, a small party acting as best it could. Why do you think there was so little effort made to get through to Luxembourg? I mean, did you know our existence?
Now, wait a minute. This was the war time when it wasn't allowed to get through anywhere.
Before 1914, perhaps.
She was murdered on January the 15th, 1918, when everybody here was still conscripted. I mean, most of the members of our party were on the run. You're right about not having time to get in touch with her, but, I mean, what could anybody do about it? She'd already been murdered, and all the events were taking place as they were. But one other thing I would say, I personally will never take part in what I call this body snatching. You know, the communists used to do it. Marx belongs to us, and for a long time Rosa Luxemburg belonged to them. And all the things that she said about Lenin, well, they said if only she'd have, you know, still lived, she'd have come round and all this sort of thing. And then eventually Stalin discovered that she wasn't so good as they thought she was, and the whole of the Institute of Red Professors was turned on denigrating Rosa Luxemburg and pointing out how many kinds of, you know, she was. So, I mean, I don't think the Socialist Party should say Rosa Luxemburg was really ours, or if she was alive today, she would join us. You can't. I mean, that was the circumstance then, and it's vastly different today, very much. We've got all the advantage of 50 years' bitter experience, the advantage of hindsight, and it's very easy to stand up here and say, poor old Rosa was wrong, capitalism won't collapse, the trade unions' mass strikes won't do it, it's got to be the education of the workers. Very easy to say. But it's still true, of course.
I don't feel that you've answered the question, because I think there were a couple of, or at least one, conference of the Second International that the SPGB sent delegates to,
right,
in order to see what was going on,
right,
whether they could link up with any other principled socialist sections in the Second International.
Yep, correct.
And they found that they were very isolated and were able to make very few contacts. So that they did make an attempt to get in touch with the more principled socialist people there. But after that, you know, it seems that they no longer tried. I mean, maybe I've got it wrong.
No,
but what efforts were there after that to get in touch with principled people? I mean, not Rosa Luxemburg as an individual, but that sort of tendency on the continent.
Now, I think I'm right in saying they attended in 1905 as a result of a general invitation to all socialist organisations to attend, and found that the SDF and the ILP were also attending, and found that so many of the continental parties, like the SDF, were not really socialist parties at all, that they decided they could no longer take any part in it. In addition to that, you probably know that in 1916, the Socialist Standard was the only paper in this country which published the appeal of Liebknecht through Litvinov, who was then living in Hampstead in London, running a photography business, for the calling of the anti-war conferences in Switzerland, which took place to form the first anti-war bureau. Attempts were made to get in touch, but the SPGB decided very early on that it could take no part in the Second International so long as those parties which were in it were acting in that way.
Anyone else?
Was Rosa Luxemburg a German?
Oh, blimey.
Yes.
You must have come in
no,
late.
No, no,
she was...
Please excuse my ignorance. I'm just learning.
That's all right, you don't know. No, we're all ignorant, don't worry. That's all right. No, no, no.
Don't try and teach me without... Please just be correct.
Nobody's trying to teach you. I don't think anybody would be so presumptuous.
No,
but, now, stop a minute, for Christ's sake. I'll give you the answer if you'll stop. That means worse than the kids. No, she was born in Poland and acquired German nationality, which you could do in those days by marrying a German.
What was the economic base of their Spartacus organization? Was it? I'm asking. Was it based on the working class? Did it come?
No. Wait a minute. The Spartacus. The Spartacus group was a group of people who didn't agree with the Social Democratic Party of Germany's support of the war, were opposed to the war because they thought that it was against the interests of the establishment of socialism. Now, in the Spartacus group, there were probably, might have been anything up to 1,000, there were certainly several hundred. And therefore, the vast majority, by definition, were workers, were already proletarians. Here you are, there's a photograph of them. They're all working men. The fact that people like Rosa Luxemburg played a prominent part is easy to be explained by the fact that under the conditions of those days she had superior education. That's all. But there's no doubt that had she have had the opportunity, Rosa Luxemburg would probably have been quite willing to work in any job, and they certainly wished to be nominated for the workers' councils. But as I told you, they were refused nomination on the grounds that they weren't workers.
You mentioned earlier that the newspaper was not had no economic base, and were printed into 35 marks, and you only had 14 people reading it.
Look, we can't possibly have a dialogue. Please, friends, we cannot have a dialogue. There are other people here who would like to ask questions, so if you please give other people a chance.
I just want to be clear about what the economic base of the Spartacus movement. But they come from the workers themselves, or was it bourgeois?
Can we come back to this? There's somebody else who would like to ask a question now.
Comrade Young amplified a little on her attitude to the 1917 revolution in Russia.
Oh, yes. You see, in many ways, Rosa Luxemburg was very highly qualified because she knew Russia as well as any of them. She knew Russia as well as, and of course, spoke Polish and had a fair understanding of Russian, much better than many of the Germans. And in many cases, prior to the war, she was always the one who was called upon to write articles on the Russian and Polish question, obviously. Same as we would ask somebody in Ireland like to write about what they know and where they live. But when the actual, in addition to not standing for Polish independence, when the actual Bolshevik Revolution took place and she discovered that the Bolshevik Party was now going on the path that it took of being organised on democratic centralism, which really means domination from the top, which was the form of organisation which you probably know Lenin propounded against the Mensheviks as the only kind of organisation that could survive under Tsarist suppression. And when the events took place where the Soviets were going to be dominated by the factions of the Communist Party, as it became, and when the revolt at Kronstadt was suppressed by force, and when the Cheka was established, the Extraordinary Commission, which incidentally was in charge of one of Rosa Luxemburg's oldest party comrades, Dzerzhinsky. Many of the Poles went back and joined the Bolsheviks. She was completely opposed to this and was definitely strongly of the opinion that without democracy everything would fail. And she put down in black and white what she understood by this. As she said, the Soviets would be dominated by bureaucrats if free discussion was not allowed. So there's no doubt that she was completely opposed to the Bolshevik line.
Now, comrades, we're going to take a break now, and before we do that, we'll have to have a collection, I'm afraid. So, will members... Who will take the collection, please?
Working-class movement. I mean, you dealt with the working-class movement in Germany, who produced quite a number of intellectual giants who were versed in Marxism, and it was a very well-organised party, and had a mass support. And yet, talking about Germany in particular, the German working class as a whole in particular,
it degenerated, in a very short period of time, really, a couple of decades, two or three decades, to the Nazi regime, and what followed as a result of that. And there again, the same type of thinking, although to not to that degree, took place in every section of the working class movement throughout the world. They got involved with their own national problems of their own ruling classes. So it actually poses a question, how did the rot actually set in? I mean, it must have set in from about the 1880s onwards or something of that period. And it poses a further question, what actually is holding the working class back now? What is this blind, why this acceptance of capitalism, where a system's completely discredited, and they don't really like the system, and yet there's some, there's something they can't conceive of an alternative. So, I mean, what is the problem? How can it be eradicated? I mean, the thing about it is this, you put forward a very moving quotation from Rosa Luxemburg right at the beginning of the First World War. Well, that war was fought. The Second World War was fought. They went through the greatest economic crisis capitalism has known, I think it's true to say, in the 30s, and the real war followed that. 30 years after the end of the last war, the beginnings of another economic crisis, which may or may not reach the magnitude of the 30s crisis, and yet still no socialism. I was at my training in Rotterdam only last night, and we were talking about this, beginning of the slump, what is to be done. And I picked up a paper produced by my own union, the AUEW. It's produced for the women and youth sections, actually, but it's for the general readership. And it said, the bloke was writing it, a fellow called Roberts, he's a minorist, actually. He's saying correctly that capitalism is creating this economic crisis like they created the previous crisis, but telling the workers they must defend their jobs at all costs. Well, this seemed to be a bit of a contradiction. If he's putting the point of view correctly, that capitalism has created the crisis, it rather poses the question, get rid of capitalism. All right, you don't just accept the sack just like that. I mean, the main problem is getting rid of the system. And yet, you'd be surprised how the difficulty of getting this argument over to a dozen or so members of my union branch last night. And I've been in this union about 20 years now, I've been a branch official and all this. And they grasp the position to a certain extent. I mean, nobody's defending capitalism. Nobody's saying, capitalism's a bloody good system. They're all saying it's no use, but they can't conceive of an alternative. Their only conception is further nationalisation. And yet they know themselves nationalisation is discrediting. So what the hell is holding the working class back? What is the barrier? Because until this is resolved, we're going nowhere.
Could I contribute at this point in reply to the speaker previous to yourself? See, it seems to me that people are saying something like this, and I may have misunderstood you. You seem to be saying something like, people have got to come to the realisation, I think those are the exact words, that socialism is a necessity. Well, I'll quote your chairman, Marin, where do correct thoughts come from? Do they fall from heaven? No, practice. Involvement in a practical situation, and therefore I would suggest that the workers come to the realisation that the system is not viable and that a new system is realised, not through intellectual discussion alone, although that's important, but through concrete practical activity at the shop floor to begin with, which then must transfer itself to the political level. Now, that's why I asked the question earlier, what kind of organisational links, what kind of relationship, what's your attitude towards the people at the shop floor, the rank and file people, especially the people who are sort of shop stewards who are going against the official union? This is absolutely important, in my opinion, because I believe that this is where the realisation that socialism is necessary comes from. And it doesn't just come from the fact that by involving themselves in practical activity at the shop floor, wage demands, conditions and so on, the way the relations of production are organised, because obviously it's not just a case of wages. Because if you alter the relationships of production, the way that people relate to each other, the authority structure, if you weaken this, then the whole thing starts to grind to a halt. It's not just the money that you're taking off them, or rather getting the money that they've taken from you, It's the fact that you're altering the relationship within the industry such that it can't be run on a viable basis in capitalism. And this is why this kind of activity, to my mind, is supremely important, because in the long run, capitalism, I believe, does have contradictions. And I think that Rosa Luxemburg hit on something when she said that you can't sort of have accumulation in a sort of closed capitalist system that you're doing in the third world for exploitation purposes. There's more than a grain of truth in that, even though the way that she presented it could be faulted. I mean, we're already seeing this in the way that commodity prices are having a devastating effect on the capitalist system at the moment. Now, these things are sort of all linked together, and you can't separate them out. And to try and suggest, as it seems to me it has been suggested, that, you know, the kind of realisation comes without concrete activity seems to be putting the thing on its head. I think both have got to go together. And then this thing about why workers sort of haven't responded so far or come to the realisation, it's because in the last 20-odd years, capitalism has been delivering the goods. And the same thing happened in Germany from 1871 up to about 1890-odd. It was extremely successful at the start of industrialised for the first time. In a big way. It was really well organised, and the workers were getting better off, and then came a slump. And Rosa Luxemburg and various other people pointed this out, that this was only sort of, just because you've got a 20-odd year period of sort of relative prosperity anyway, that this sort of thing doesn't continue forever. And people pointed this out in the 50s and 60s in this country, when everybody were giving up the ghost and saying the workers have sold their birthright for a mess of pottage. It's the fact that capitalism can't deliver the goods sustainably over a long period. And if the workers make demands on the capitalist system, which is theirs by right, of monetary demands and the way that the thing's organised, which can't survive, you know, with different relations of production without an authority structure and so on, then this helps to bring capitalism to a position where it's in fundamental contradiction to further development. And this is a period when the workers will come to the realisation that the system must give way to a socialist system. But all the time this is going on, there's activity taking place between the industrial level and the political level. And that's why I think it's important, I don't think I've received a satisfactory answer so far, just to, as to what attitude a revolutionary party ought to take to the shop floor activity.
Does anybody want to join in on this? Before, you want to sum up?
Well, I suppose I've got to, I don't know.
Now, would it not be better if we let people join in and then you sum up at the end?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Well, I'd like to, again...
Wait a minute, Harry. Comrade Baldwin was first.
Well, I'm thinking of our friend here, the contributor, of him as something in the same line that he seems to see us, namely that he's putting all his emphasis on one particular thing, or all his money on one particular horse in the class race stakes, as it were. I defy him to show, or anybody who takes this line, that there is any demonstrable correlation between experience on the industrial shop floor level and the development of the socialist movement at all. I could show mountains of evidence that there's a very strong correlation between experience of organisation at the industrial shop floor level and the development of a hierarchy in the Labour Party, feathering its nest on the political and economic ignorance of the working class, climbing up on the backs of a careerist movement on their way to the House of Lords. There's plenty of evidence to show that nationalised boards and all kinds of bureaucratic officialdom are people who have served the establishment well, and for whom, having rendered their service, they've been recognised by the establishment of capitalism. So I don't think that you can, without any evidence, simply assert that there's this more than a correlation, a direct and almost automatic link between experience on the shop floor, industrial level, and the conscious development of a political movement for socialism on the other. I think this is extremely questionable, to say the least. Now, it doesn't mean to say that what was organising on the shop floor level to struggle over wages and conditions do not face an aspect of capitalism, the downward pressure of the capitalist class on their wages and conditions, and to come to this kind of attitude that Comrade Simpkins has expressed and Comrade Waters, that they're aware that they're fighting in the dark against forces that they don't understand, and they find from the sheer necessity of their situation they've got to put up some kind of organised resistance to it. But as to understanding it, from generation on to generation, they seem to be fighting the same fight over and over. And again, to say that this is such an argument is so in a state of imbalance that it ignores all kinds of other experience. It ignores also the fact that two-thirds of the working class in this country, two-thirds of the labour force in this country alone, are not organised into trade unions in any event. But does one say that two-thirds of the labour force of this country are therefore experiencing nothing and learning nothing from their existence and their oppressive environment under capitalism, and are not being prodded by every hour of their waking life towards a slowly developing awareness of the world they live in with all its interconnecting relationships, its struggles and oppressions? People who have lived through wars and lost relatives and near ones and so on live in a world which, having promised them peace and a war to end war, is now on to the teeth with nuclear bombs. This is as much an aspect in the knocking at the door of working class consciousness to demand an answer to say, well, does a third world war inevitably mean oblivion, or is there some answer we can come up with which, so far as we are concerned, can only be interpreted in terms of changing society to get rid of the causes out of which war arises? Also, people as parents and as children are very much concerned with the education rat race and the poverty, which is an aspect of working class poverty. If you look at the back streets, slum schools built 100 years ago that many tens of thousands of working class kids go to up and down the country, they're aware of the contrast between these and the private schools with high fees that members of the capitalist class send their children to. All of this, again, prompts them to become aware of the class division in society and the privileged structure of the private property institutions upon which capitalism is built, and the sheer sort of unfairness of them of it initially prompts them to think, you know, even at an emotional level, that something is wrong about society that presents these sort of contradictions, and something should be done about it. Pollution again. The television unwittingly in having discussion programs with all kinds of academic people to talk about the destruction of the physical environment by pollutive activity in industry and so on, chemical pollution and all kinds of adulteration and so on of the physical environment. This itself tells people that the way society is being run and organised is irrational and poses the question, what could be done about it? So it's another aspect of consciousness development. And the general unsatisfactory nature of the environment in which we live, struggling to get by from week to week, making ends meet, and the whole oppression of capitalism in all its ramifications, the sum total of these add up to one tremendous motivating force in development of working class consciousness towards the inevitable end of changing society, not just the industrial shop floor level, which is an aspect of it, but only a tiny aspect of the overall picture.
Well, to get back to Comrade Wilkie's point, how did this come about with the German working class, with this great Marxist theoreticians, big party? Working class party, how it degenerated. Well, I think the problem today is similar in this country as it was in those times, and I should say before, not so much in Germany, but in Austria, Hungary, before the First World War, which is I don't know how socialists can combat it, but it's a great problem with socialists, with the socialist movement, how they can, and Rosa Luxemburg suffered for her life with it, how they can combat the fear of people from abroad, people that they think different religion, different race or something, how we can combat this is a great problem to us. It's a problem of nationalism, as he says, is plaguing the world. What's the answer the Germans are giving to the unemployment in Germany today? Yes, we can send them back. One out of two German workers, in a census, has said that the foreign workers should go back. And the government is pandering to the working class. Here's your point. Here's the government pandering to the working class. They like 500,000 jobs to show. And the German working class won't lift a finger to see these people being sent back after they've helped the German economy. Listen.
Yes, Comrade Chairman, I'll be brief as I can. Arising out of our friend's discussion there, first of all, I would agree with him 100% when he implies in his contribution that mere advocacy of socialism on our behalf will never get socialism. I agree, it wouldn't. And he goes on to say that it's by a combination of the two, of experience and the application of socialist theory, that he expects results. Now let's have a look at that. Obviously, it is out of the inability of the capitalist system to solve the problems that it engenders in relation to the working class that give the working class its experience. Now the working class in this and other countries have had about 200 to 300 years experience of capitalist society. What is it that we want the workers to learn from their experience? Do we want the workers to learn from their experience that the capitalism is an impossible society as far as their problems are concerned? Or do we want the working class to have more and more of the same experience? Now, quite obviously, if you have a section of the working class that have come to the viewpoint that socialism is the only answer, then it's obvious that we don't want to go and insist upon the working class having a further instalment of the experiences of that they've had before. The experience of the inability of reforms to do anything. The experience of supporting leaders. The experience of letting a hierarchy of the trade unions do their thinking for them. What we want to do is for the working class to sum up their experience in the same way as we've summed it up. In the final analysis, the only way to resolve the problem is by socialism. I mean, this idea that people have got, it's like, for example, an instructor teaching somebody to teaching somebody to drive. The instructor doesn't say to the person driving, well, drive on the opposite side of the road, because eventually you'll meet a lorry, you'll have a crash, and you'll know by experience that you're making a mistake. Of course we don't want to do that. What we want to show is that the working class, when they make these mistakes, they'll get the bloody results of them, and they'll go on getting the results of them. And it's about time they packed up making these mistakes and came to the same conclusions as we did. Now, obviously, there is a difficulty. The only thing that we can do in relation to trade unions is to point out the limitations of trade unions and do our best as socialists within a trade union to get the people in trade unions, as we do with people outside of trade unions, to understand socialism. And until the working class in the majority, unless and until they get that idea, then you can have as much experience of capitalism for years and years ahead, they'll learn nothing in relation to socialism. All that will happen will be that they will make the same mistakes, and at the behest of people who appoint themselves as leaders, self-styled revolutionaries, who will only lead them up the garden. Now it's about time that we say that the working class got down to it and understood socialism. And there's nothing else, as far as I can see, as a member of a trade union, and as somebody who's had experience in trade unions, and as somebody that understands socialism. The working class have got to understand socialism. There's no two ways about it.
Anyone else?
Yes.
Ronnie.
Yeah, I don't... Just, please don't think, by the way, that we're all picking on what you say. It's just we're all after you. It's just you said several interesting things, and you've set us all going. Don't think that we're all sort of trying to jump on you, because we're not. One of the things you did say, I think, was that if there are situations under capitalism where things get worse, like slumps or crises, unemployment, war, the contradictions get greater, and from this, the workers are going to learn about socialism. Is that right? So the sort of line you were putting. Well, you see, we dispute this because, in fact, the contradictions, the fundamental contradictions of capitalist society, are there the whole time. You see, you look about what goes on. I mean, the point about the relationship of capitalist society is any society is a production of wealth. Now, what happens in the production of wealth under capitalist society? You get the working class, the vast majority of people, producing an enormous amount of wealth, quite fantastic. When you look about and see what is produced, but it's just amazing. You think of the amount that's wasted alone, and yet everything still goes on. Obviously, there's a fabulous amount of wealth produced. And yet, that wealth that they produce, they don't own. Now, that is a contradiction which doesn't come out of unemployment. In fact, it comes out of employment. It comes out of the normal workings, in inverted commas, if you like, of capitalist society. Now, that is a contradiction which capitalist society will never get rid of. It's essential in its absolute day-to-day running. Now, that contradiction doesn't get worse or greater or less when there's unemployment or when there's a war, when there's a crisis. There's just other things going on as well, which in fact sometimes just confuse the issue. It's that contradiction and the experience of that contradiction, which the working class can't avoid, the experience of producing wealth yet living in relative poverty in comparison to what they produce. It's that contradiction that we say will eventually, must eventually, teach them that there's something wrong with this society, independent of what we, the Socialist Party, can do. I mean, we're only small, we do what we can, but that contradiction, which is there the whole time, will show them that eventually they've got to get rid of this system, they've got to start looking for something else. But it's got nothing to do with the system getting worse or better or faster or slower or bigger slumps or better slumps. That's sort of a lot of left-winger arc, you know, kick capitalism and it'll collapse or fall down. It won't. It'll go on with its contradictions, which are there when it's doing well. The contradictions in the 1960s, when capitalism was on its boom and the working class had never had it so good, were just as strong, just as glaring to anybody who cared to look, as they are now when this great crisis is about to hit us. It's been about to hit us, you know, for 6 months, a year, and it keeps coming. It's going to be a... Obviously, in America, for example, a lot of people out of work, that's a tremendous thing that will hit a lot of American workers. I mean, there was a report in the paper yesterday about the $40,000-plus society of the unemployed that's just been started in America. Now, these workers there never thought they were workers. They've only just realised it because they've been given the sack. I mean, they were earning $40,000 a year. They couldn't be workers. But in fact, when the capitalism continues with employed or unemployed, sooner or later they're going to realise that in fact that's what they are, and their interest is opposed to that of the capitalist class, and they've got to look for another form of society. And it's got nothing to do with crises. The more you try and make crises, the more you're just going to confuse people. We're only seen in sort of forcing crises. We want to get rid of the damn thing.
Oh, no, that's
any help for that.
Very good.
Well, I just want to say, Chairman, that there's been many slumps in the future, but there's been many slumps in the past, and it's never led to any great development of socialist knowledge. And I think anyone who thinks that socialist knowledge is going to suddenly come out of any future slump, they're going to find a mistake. And slumps have always been followed, sooner or later, by booms. And I can't see much socialist knowledge coming out of any future slump in the next year or so. But I would like also to comment on Comrade Young mentioned about 50 years. It's all right to criticise now, point out the errors of Rosa Luxemburg after 50 years hindsight, where you can see things more clearly. But if you look at the SPGB in its early days when Rosa Luxemburg first started writing, the party members at that time knew that capitalism would not collapse. Rosa Luxemburg didn't. The party members at that time knew that socialism
would become a worldwide system. Rosa Luxemburg didn't think that was possible. The party members at that time knew that an armed uprising by a minority would end in be squashed by bloodshed. Yet Rosa Luxemburg took part in an armed uprising by a small minority. Party members at that time knew that the general strike was of no use for the working class to gather, capture state power. Yet Rosa Luxemburg stated that the general strike is the most effective weapon in the struggle of the proletariat. All those questions, all those the party members 60, 70 years ago knew the answer to. Yet in every single case, Rosa Luxemburg took the opposite view. So therefore, despite her many admirable qualities, I don't think you can say that she was a sound Marxist.
Would the Germans say that the SVGP is about the Marxist Revolution Party? Like the Labour Party, of course, is about the Marxist Revolution Party, and they all want an economic activity. Would deny this economic activity? As a general organisation.
Yeah, try.
Anyone else?
I wanted to come back for the last time, if that's all right.
No, I think if you wish to, by all means, go in.
Well, I agree with the speaker about the fundamental contradiction between non-ownership of the means of production, that that's just a form of words in a way. I mean, you sort of analyse it and you say, look, you know, you've got these guys who own the means of production and they put the ideology out and all this business and make people think the way they want and so on and so forth. They own it. And the people who actually make it, as it were, the real foundation of it, don't have any say, real say in how it's run, and they don't get the rewards and the fruits of it and so on. Well, that's true enough. It's just sort of analysing it and looking at it. But what does it mean in practice? This is the problem. And you can only come to a realisation of this by the practical implications of it. And I suggest that when you get into periods of slump and crisis, that these are periods when it's brought home glaringly. Not to deny, as the speaker said at the back there, that there's all sorts of other contradictions and sort of expressions of the sort of fundamental contradictions of capitalism taking place at the same time. I mean, these are going on as well. The industrial aspect is the most important aspect. I think somebody tonight said a tiny part of it. Absolute wrong analysis altogether. It's not a tiny part of it. Even though you may say there's only a third of the working class at work who are enrolled in trade unions, well, you're understating a bit. There's 10 million out of about 25 million, which is 40% anyway, but I'm not quibbling about figures. But 10 million people, my goodness. And most of these, a big proportion of these, are the main breadwinners of the family. So what kind of income these people get, it's fundamental to their whole life. I mean, you can't deny that. So it must be, it can't be overstressed that it's not a tiny part, it's a fundamentally important part. Now, I believe that the slumps and crises are opportunities to bring the working class to a realisation of the situation and the contradictions of capitalism, which we have. And obviously, I think most of this, from what I've been saying, will come through the actual situation that we're in, but that's not enough. There's got to be a political expression of this. Now, Rosa Luxemburg, for all her faults, used the example of the situation in Russia in 1905, 1907, the mass strikes which were occurring then. And these did lead to political repercussions. It did arouse the consciousness of the Russian working class tremendously. A strike would start over a few kopecks a week with some bus drivers or whatever, and it accelerated into the right of representation in Parliament. Before it was done, before it was a few weeks old, it had spread throughout the whole country. And all sorts of political questions were raised and remained there afterwards. As she says, it fertilised the ground for the political activity later on. So, you know, I can't accept, one, that sort of crises, the working class don't learn anything from crises, because if I might just quote the example of the 30s, we had a situation there where, I'm fairly simplifying this, but we had a situation where the working class, as it were, placed a trust, if you will, in the official trade union leadership. As a result of this, they got defeated in the 1926 general strike and the slump which followed. Now, I believe that the growth of the shop stewards movement in the 50s and 60s is partly an indication that the working class did learn the lessons that the official trade unions couldn't be trusted, as it were. And I also believe that the fact that the Labour Party hadn't delivered the goods in the 30s, as it were, had been expressed by the fact that the fallen support for the Labour Party over the last few decades. The working class does learn from slumps and crises. And I believe that the most important thing, and I must get back to this again, is that we've got to establish links with the working class in their industrial organisations, especially at the unofficial level, because there we are helping to expose the official trade union leadership for what it is. And the other thing is that, getting back to the comrade's sort of contribution earlier, that it isn't just in the industrial sphere that these, that the sort of awareness of the sort of drawbacks of capitalism, as it were, and the need for socialism arises. We've got all sorts of things springing up almost spontaneously, to use a Luxembourgian phrase, in things like tenants' action groups and so on. These things are an expression of the working class showing its dissatisfaction with the way things are organised in capitalist society. So it's not just even a question of sort of rank and file trade union movement, it's also a question of things like tenants' action groups and these sorts of things, which in a way are the embryonic forms of the working class coming to terms with the fact that capitalist society isn't viable. And I believe that any revolutionary party should be forming some kind of institutional link with these organisations so that on the strength of what happens industrially it can be explained, as it were, politically, and on the strength of this political explanation of the situation that they're in, that further activity will take place on those levels and the thing will work on it as a process.
I quite agree with you.
Comrade, just a minute. Somebody had his hand up first. We must have order. Please. Sir Ronis has one comrade in Sinkin said about the apparent contradiction there. Here you have capitalism going on and on, creating crises, yet in mass terms, the working class do not seem to respond in a socialist manner. Why, he asked Comrade Young, is this? Well, there are two ways of looking at capitalism, as Marx so crisply pointed out many times. You can look at it nominally, and this is what the working class do. They see capitalism as something that has always existed and always will exist. Now, this is the conundrum. The capitalist class, by virtue of having control of the propaganda machine, engender this sort of thinking at a very early age, so that wherever you go in industry today, and after all, the members of the SPGB are members of the working class, we are in trade unions, wherever you go, you will not see the working class challenging capitalism. Show me where the cowardly workers have ever expressed dissatisfaction with capitalism as a social form of production and distribution. Not a bit of it. And that applies to Germany, Russia, China, and other parts of the capitalist world. Now, there is another way of looking at capitalism, and that is the socialist dialectical way. For socialists, when the problems of industry and capitalism in general, wars, etc., occur, we don't see them at face value. We immediately start looking for underlying causes. Now, it is only when the working class begin to see below the surface of the problem, begin to demand an explanation, that their intellect will more and more become amenable to the propaganda of the Socialist Party of Great Britain and its companion parties. Now, that is the conundrum. Capitalism is strong because, one, The capitalist class control the propaganda agencies, and they have created, didn't Marx so rightly say, tradition weighs like an Alp upon the mind, the tradition of the past weighs like an Alp upon the mind of the living. How true this is. Now, when the working class, and not before, are in a position, both in the industrial field, and remember what the socialist movement has always said, that the trade union movement itself can only become effective when you have a socialist consciousness amongst the majority of its membership. Not before. You, the industrialists, however sincere you are, however active you are achieving nothing in the progressive sense. As my comrade down here pointed out, capitalism, whether it is booming or whether it is in a declining, it's still capitalism, and the workers remain in precisely the same condition. Only when they want a change, and that change must result, first of all, in their thinking, not in superficial terms, but in dialectical terms, then and only then will you get a mass movement towards socialism.